So we were, I talked to you all about compatibility methods and making cliques and when that doesn't work. I want to mention before I go totally away from that subject that when you have some of these other problems like multiple states, like DNA, where the clique scheme doesn't work, or where you have missing data, there is another way, and that is simply to do a parsimony method, but have that parsimony method only count steps up to the number that will be completely compatible. So for 0-1 data, it'll count steps. If there are 0 steps in a character, or 1, or more than 1, if you go 2 or more, that means the character is incompatible. If you have DNA with 4 states, if you get above 3 steps, then you're incompatible. Or not above 3, but above whatever, 1 less than the number of states that you have at that position. So a particular position had only 3 possible states, A, C, and G, and there were no T's. Above 2 steps, and you're incompatible. So you can actually just do a parsimony method where you tell the parsimony method, you modify it, that it's basically counting compatible and incompatible at each position by just looking at the number of steps. And then you have to do the usual business of searching tree space. So that's another way to do it. It isn't as fast as when you get cliques to work. I will also say that one course-related thing that I forgot to say. Most of you have turned in homeworks. There may be one or two of you that haven't turned in homeworks. Keep going and turn those homeworks in. If you can catch me before I start grading them, I'll be okay with that. What I don't like to do is go back later and have to do a second round of grading. Okay. And the other thing I said was I whizzed through this, so I think I whizzed through it too quickly. The use of compatibility-like methods in tests in haplotypes in populations of a single species where there are SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, which means that at some site there are 2 different possible states, and one of them you take to be the normal state, and the other you make a hash mark to indicate, oh, that's where that's the variant. You can go either way, you know, you can declare either of them to be the variant, it doesn't matter for our purposes. Here is a set of simulated SNPs, simulated in a population that has not only genetic drift, but recombination as well. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole, we will touch upon later in the course the fact that with just genetic drift in a population, you get tree-like histories of alleles. But when you put recombination in, they aren't nearly so tree-like. So if you have a set of haplotypes like this, you might want to know, is there evidence for recombination here? If there isn't any recombination, then and if the rate of mutation is low, then all of these sites should fit on the same tree-like history of alleles. So here, one thing you can do is you can compute between pairs of sites, pairs of varying sites, measures that are of what's called linkage disequilibrium, or LD, which many of you will have run into it before. It's a measure of how associated the those 2 sites are. You can do it for every pair of sites. And there's a particular measure called D prime, which measures whether the association is as large as it could possibly be. It standardizes the linkage disequilibrium, the covariation between these sites, by a number that's the largest possible. And if you compute that for pairs of sites for this, for these data here, here are all the numbers of the varying sites. Let's see. Some of the sites have only a single variant at them, and so those you don't, those are always compatible with all sites. They're always at maximum LD. Here's a measure of this thing D prime, its absolute value. One will mean it's as, it is as associated as it could possibly be. The black squares here are basically D prime of one. If they were, there was no recombination, and if you were, had a tree-like history, which you do expect to have from genetic drift, of the, of those individual copies of genes, you'd expect this whole triangle here to be black. You'd expect them all to be at maximum value of LD. When you look at it, you see it isn't. There's a few sites that are mutually at maximum LD here, a little block here, a block there, maybe something here, and then down here is another block. What that means is there are different patches of locations along the molecule, each of which shows evidence of a tree-like history, but they're different tree-like histories. So there is, there has been some recombination or multiple mutations at these sites. If you take, if you don't want to compute this LD thing, there's a quick and dirty method that was invented a long time ago, and that is you take the pair of sites you're looking at and you, you see whether they pass what's called the three gamete test. So here are sites 21 and 22. And it basically says, of the four possible combinations, do you get all of them? And is, or is it three and fewer combinations? Well, you'll recognize that. That's E.O. Wilson's compatibility test. So it was reinvented in population genetics. These two sites are at maximum LD. They pass the three gamete test, so do these. And then there are others that do as well, but I just was showing you those two examples. Please. Which part of the last?
No, the conclusion of the last slide, how you came to the conclusion that because you see an array of different values for LD, how, and how that relates to the patches idea, and how that...
Well, it turns out, let me go back to what I, to just show this. When you have two sites that are compatible with each other, and have only three of the four combinations, three or fewer of the four combinations, this D prime statistic reaches one or minus one. It reaches its maximum possible value for a positive or negative association. So, in effect, wherever you see black here, you're up at this point on the scale, and essentially you've got complete linkage disequilibrium. So the black squares show you where there's complete disequilibrium. Now, if you see a group of sites, numbers 14, 15, 16, 17, and 19, those five sites, if you made a square and you duplicate this, it's there entirely black. All pairs are compatible. These are 0-1 traits. The pairwise compatibility theorem will work and say there is a single tree that will fit all of those. They will be able to evolve on it with only a single mutational event. And likewise, this bunch here, sites 24, 25, 28, 29, 30, and 31. Well, actually not. 28 has a slightly different color. So it's actually 28, 29. Let's see if I get this right. 28, 29, and 30 are 28, 29, 30, and 31. Four sites are mutually, also mutually compatible. They have a single tree that will fit them, but it isn't the same tree as will fit here. Otherwise, you'd have some black stuff connecting them.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm not really telling you the formulas for D prime. There really is, they aren't needed for this argument, and that's a different course. That's a year from now. Okay, so the whole point is that this three gamete test that's used in genomics just is the compatibility machinery. And it is a way of looking at a bunch of sites and seeing quickly if they if they're all going to fit on the same tree of genealogy of ancestry of the gene of the haplotype copies. Okay, so we're departing from compatibility. We're going to start getting a little more in the way of probability and statistics now. And what I'm going to talk about is I'll start by talking about character weighting and a probability model that gives you some insight into the weighting of characters and into what these mysterious weights ought to be and how they depend upon things we might think we knew about the characters, such as rates of evolution. What I'm going to do is consider a case of two states. And instead of just saying, well, they can change back and forth, I'm going to say, well, there is a rate, a probabilistic model for going back and forth between those, with a rate R. And what a rate means in probability terms is that in a small chunk of time of width dt, so this is time, the probability of change of getting, say if you start at a zero, of getting a one, given that you start at a zero and you evolve for a length of time, a little smidgen of time dt, that is a certain rate r times the width of the time interval. Now that's only true for very, 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 for infinitesimally short times. There is a more complete formula up here, which I'll get to in a second. So we're imagining that R is the rate per unit time of the process of probabilistic change from 0 to 1. And I'm assuming symmetry here, that you go back and forth at equal rates. Now, if you ask yourself, OK, in longer times, how long will what is the net chance of changing? If the process is very much like you're walking down the street and you're on one side of the street on the sidewalk and you're walking along, and every so often you say, oh, I think I'll walk on the other side and switch over. And there's a certain rate at which that happens. Well, you go down the street, you switch sides and you continue, and then maybe later you'll switch back and you go on and maybe switch back again. You get to the end of the block. What's the probability that you end up on a different side of the street? Okay. Well, I will not give you the derivation of this, but it basically follows this formula. It says if R is the rate at which these impulses arrive that cause you at random times to cause you to cross the street, and if the length of the block here measured, we're thinking of a branch and a tree and time, is t, it'll depend upon the product of r times t, so basically what's the average number, the expected number of brainstorms that you get going down the block. Yeah?
Are we assuming that r is symmetric?
It's a single quantity. Yeah, we're assuming that the arrival of these feelings that the grass is greener on the other side of the hill is the same no matter which side of the block you're on, which I think is the question you're asking. Yeah. So it's this scheme here, same rate forward and backwards. If you have different rates in the two, the math is slightly more complicated, but similar but slightly more complicated. And what turns out, the formula is 1/2 1 minus e to the minus 2 rt. The curve of it as a function of the product rt is like this. It goes up nearly linearly when t is small, when the block is short. And that's because there isn't time to cross the block more than once. You might cross no times or one time. But it's basically very rare that anybody would ever cross and then come back by the end of that short an amount of time. But as time goes on, you get some instances of coming back. And in the end, in the long run, it approaches 1/2. And it does so for obvious reasons. The whole process is symmetrical. And therefore, if you wait a long time, you'll lose any history. You'll lose any effective history. And you'll be on one side or the other at random. And that's 50%. Okay. So there's the formula. Now what we're going to do is really just talk about this part. When you're down in this part, the block is very short, or the rate of arrival of these impulses of novelty seeking. In that case, it's basically linear. It's basically the product RT. So the probability that you will end up with in the other state is going to essentially be RT. If you take RT small, this formula will show you that. And the probability you don't change is 1 minus that. Okay. So that's all by way of just getting to that rather simple result. But how are we going to use this? What we're going to do is we're going to compute the probability of our data set in a particular character that we're looking at on a given tree. Now that we get, let's suppose here, here's a simple example. The other thing to say is that I forgot to say that. Whoa, I went before it instead of backwards. Okay. The latter, 1 minus RT, when RT is small, 1 minus RT will be approximating by saying, well, let's just call it 1. Now, that seems a little dubious, but you'll see it'll be okay. So we're approximating the 1 minus RTs by 1. Suppose I have a 4-species tree with zeros and ones, and we observe the data at the 4 tips. And here's the data, 2 zeros at this end, 2 ones at that end. We do not observe the stuff in the middle. We don't observe the ancestral states, the hypothetical ancestral states. We don't know what they are. But there are 4 possibilities. These 2 could be 0, this could be a 0, this a 1, this a 1 and that a 0, or this a 1 and that a 1. So these are the same data set, but reconstructing the interior states in all 4 possible ways. And suppose we say, well, let's figure out the overall probability of getting these data summing up over our uncertainty about the ancestral states. Let's add up the probabilities of all possible scenarios where those scenarios involve different choices for the ancestral states. Okay. So, if you look at this scenario here, there is no net change in this branch, there's no net change in that. I should also say we have to start somewhere, we have to put a root somewhere if we want to compute it. But let's put the root at the left-hand end of the central branch. It could be anywhere and we will get the same, we'll actually get the same answer no matter where we put it. But if you started out at state 0, well, we don't know if that is state 0. The probability that it is state 0, if there has been a long evolutionary process using the same process up to that point, the probability of being in state 0 is just 1/2. So we have to put a 1/2 in for the state, the probability of whatever state we assume at the root. Now here, you'll see, there's no change, no change, no change, 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 okay? If we number these tips 1, 2, 3, 4, and the interior nodes like 5, if we number the branches, we can also number the branches, branch 1, branch 2, branch 3, branch 4, and this interior one we'll call 5. Then the probability of this whole thing happening will be 1/2 times the probability of no change, no change, no change, but this probability of change and that probability of change. And what that's going to be is 1/2 times RT, R times the length in time of this branch, R, which is T3, R times the length of time in that branch, which we'll call T4, and then there'll be 3 other terms, which are 1 minus RTs out there. Those, we're all going to be interested in the case where RT is rather small, so those will all sort of be close to 1. So we're leaving them out. Now that's the one where I'm taking a little license and sort of asking you to accept that. This one here has how many changes? How many branches show a net change?
One.
One. and it's the anterior branch. So the same similar term will be a half times R T5. This one, how many branches show a neck change?
Four.
Yeah, four is a good approximation to five. So I think that it is if you're buying and I'm giving you change, yes. You might not feel the same way. Every branch shows a change. Okay, so the terms you get here are RT1, RT2, RT3, RT4, RT5, all of them. Okay. Here, the bottom one, how many changes? There are two of them on branches 1 and 2. So if you take these terms and add them up, they are the probability of the data on that tree. Now, the probability of the data given the tree is known as the likelihood, probability of data given tree. So, and we'll get back to likelihood. We're coming to it as a major framework for inferring trees, but this is not the introduction of likelihood. This is a pre-introduction. If you look at this quantity and say, well, suppose that RT, the RTs are all very small quantities, okay, what will this sum look like? And the answer, it'll be small thing times small thing, so roughly something of the order of small things squared, a single small thing, five small things, and two small things. In that case, the extreme limiting case where these RT quantities are small, I claim that almost all of the probability you get here will come from this term, because it's only got one small quantity multiplied. So where we are headed is to say the likelihood, the probability of the data given the tree, we're going to compute it. We're going to assume, to ask, we'll assume it's a good thing to maximize that likelihood, to make the observed data that we see, that we have seen, to come up with basically a scenario that makes it as probable as it could be. I was going to say as probable as possible, but that's too hard to, to remember or think about. So what we're doing is, in each character, we're summing over the ancestral reconstructions, and then you have one of these terms, which is a one-half for the ancestral state, and then a product over the branches. So there are five branches there. And in each branch, it's either an RT or a 1 minus RT, where the R is the R for that character. We're assuming that the characters each have a rate of change. They might be different. And the T's, the lengths of the branch T, we're not assuming are the same. They're subscripted with the number of that branch. So that's the formula for the likelihood at a single character. And then this product out here is the product over characters, which is to say we're assuming that what's going on in each character, they're all evolving on the same tree, but they're evolving independently. Okay, so this is all just saying that. Okay. We'll see that maximizing the likelihood later will argue that it's a good thing. But what we're interested in now is what the relationship of this is to parsimony. And in fact, it gives us a justification for certain kinds of weighted parsimony. That's where we're headed. Same thing, continuing on, we're almost there. So what we get, if we toss out in each character all the terms that have more than the smallest possible number of RTs. So remember when we had four possibilities, I argued that the probability will be dominated by the one that has only one product RT. That means for each, we'll consider only for each character the reconstruction of ancestors that has the fewest number of changes of state, because that'll give us the fewest number of these RT terms. The likelihood then will come out looking like this. For for one character, character I, it'll be the product over branches. This is the symbol, this is like the symbol for a sum, but it's the symbol for product of the T for that branch. Let's see, I'm wrong. This should be a J. That should be a J. The product for J goes 1 to B of the length of the branch times the R for that character raised to a power which is the number of changes in that character, in that branch, in this most parsimonious reconstruction. And if you think about it, that's either going to, Nij is either going to be a 0 or a 1. Either it says there's no change in that branch, a 0, or there's one change in that branch.
Wait, can you repeat what N is? N's the
number
of changes.
N is the number of changes. If I make a particular reconstruction I say, well, let's take the ancestral states that achieve the most parsimony. Then, in each branch, I will either see a net change or not. And this N is just an indicator variable indicating a 1 means you did see a change, a 0 means you didn't. Okay. Now, and I had not up till today used this formula many times, never caught that the index there should be a J, but it is. Okay, there's the same formula here. Here's the product over characters. Now the interesting thing is that so approximately when these RTs are small, you can write the likelihood like this. Well, okay, fine. Now, the whole thing has depended on the RTs being small enough that no two of these RTs, when you take a product among them, can ever be bigger than a single RT, than any other single RT. Then this formula is approximately correct. So when you have these low rates of change, you get a likelihood that looks like this. Now, this is a product of lots of things. Well, sums are easier to think about than products. So let's take the logarithm. We know that the logarithm of a big product is the sum of the logs of the individual terms. We use natural logs. And I'm going to do something here. I'm not just going to take the natural log, but I'm going to take minus it. With likelihood, you're maximizing something. If I take minus the likelihood, you're minimizing something. The log is a monotonic function. If you make a quantity bigger, the log goes up. So maximizing the likelihood would be like maximizing log likelihood. If you take minus log likelihood, that quantity you want to minimize because you turned it around, made it negative. So we want to minimize this quantity. And what have we got? Well, here's the minus. What happened to the minus sign on the right side? It snuck in and it's in here. The products have become sums, so we're summing over all characters, we're summing over all branches. We're getting an indicator variable whether there was a change on that branch. And this thing is minus the log of this RT quantity. So what it says is, this is a parsimony count where we give a penalty for this change. If there is a 1 here, a penalty of minus log RT. So there's a natural scheme of penalties that says you can do this whole estimation by parsimony if you make the right penalties, and the right penalties depend upon the rates of change in the character R and the length of the branch in time. Now the problem is that this is fine. It's if you're taking branch length into account, it isn't really a parsimony method anymore. I'm going to sort of fudge over that. But I'm going to say that there is a sort of natural assignment of weights, and the natural assignment of weights goes as minus the log of the expected number of changes on that branch in character I, in branch J. What that says is that if the rate of change of a character is small, this quantity gets small, its log gets small, its minus log gets big. So the weight gets big for a character that's changing at a very low rate. At a character that's changing at a high rate, the weight gets small. Now this corresponds to, it's intuitively plausible, because it says, should we get upset by a change? And the answer is, well, if it's a very rare event, we should be very surprised by it. But if it's a fairly, not so rare event, we shouldn't be nearly as surprised. We shouldn't be nearly as worried about making a reconstructed history that includes not quite so improbable events as we should if they are an equivalent number of very improbable events. So it does the right thing. It also says, by the way, that the weight should be less the longer the branch is, because there's basically more time for these improbable events to occur. So we're not too surprised if they occur on that branch. But again, in doing parsimony, the length of branch is sort of not there and not being taken into account. Nobody has a parsimony method which makes blanks for all the branches and then assigns penalties based in part on those lengths. So in that sense, this is different from that. So we end up this by just computing some numbers. Those weights, which are minus the log of r times t, I'll write it up here, minus natural log of r for character I, t for branch j. Let's, in some imaginary case, this is not even a real set of data. It's not even a real imaginary set of data. Let's imagine three different characters on some tree where the number of changes that we see in those characters is 1 in the first character, 2 in the second character, and 1 in the third character. And let's imagine that the RTs are 0.01 in the first character, 0.01 in the second, which basically says, by the way, there's a 1%, you expect 1% of a change in that branch, and 10 to the minus 5 in this one. Now let's compute those minus the log of RT quantities. Very easy to do. Just take minus the log of that. And this one is 4.605. That one, the total penalty will be 9.201. It's exactly twice that. The third one has a penalty of 11.5. Okay, it's a rarer event. You give it more penalty. So now you can see that if you're choosing by these weights, tree one or character one is accumulating less. It's accumulating less, noticeably less penalty than character three, even though they have the same number of changes, because those changes are much less probable in the third character. And this character here, even though it has only one change, it accumulates more penalty than another character which has two changes, because that other character has a higher probability of change. Okay, so that's just that case. But now let me show you two other cases. Let's say, well, let's imagine cases where the average probability of change is a tenth this. So we'll put an extra zero in here in each one of these. So we'll just now drop all the RTs by a factor of 10. Everything else is the same. Now the rates are 6.908, 13.816, and 13.816. So now, still true that character 1 accumulates less weight than character 3. Let me go back for a second. And here, this character accumulated almost, well, not between 2 and 3 times as much penalty as this character. When we have a lower rate of change, this is no longer more than twice as much. It's now a bit less than twice as much. These two, which have different numbers of changes, this one has two changes, this has one change, are tied in total penalty. Now let's drop by another factor of 10. Okay. here we are, this is the last of these weighted character things. And what we see is now the weight for the first character is still, it's not the same as the third character, but they're getting a little bit closer. This one is substantially less than twice as much weight. But the interesting comparison is between the second and third characters. This one has two changes, this one has one change. Now, the one with two changes is actually, it's actually accumulating more penalty than the one with one. And I claim, you can do it yourself with it if you have a logarithm function on a computer or calculator. If I put another zero in here, that these two, the ratio between these two numbers will become more equal, and this thing will accumulate even more weight than the third one. And what will happen in the limit as these characters' changes get rarer and rarer and rarer, as the rates of change of all characters go down by a factor of 10, another factor of 10, another factor of 10, in the limit, I claim, the penalty will really depend on the number of changes. Yeah.
Do we think about this process the same way for changes within a population versus changes within between different species?
Well, if the history of the copies of genes is perfectly tree-like, and we're thinking, then yes, for low enough rates of change, rates of mutation, for example, the tree that was contributing the most probability to the likelihood will be the one that is most parsimonious. And also what this does, it gives us some sort of feel for if we have different sites that have different mutation rates, it should probably be a weighted parsimony, although if there, the lesson here really is, the basic lesson here is, yes, there are different weights. The weights start to fall in line with the number of changes. And as you get to very, very low rates of change, the weights become essentially equal for each change. And when they do that, you're in parsimony land. You know, you're in the land where you can find the best tree just by being most parsimonious. So there is a connection between likelihood methods and parsimony methods in the limit when the rate of change is very low. Okay? But that's all I'm really going to say about the probabilistic justification of parsimony. That when rates are low, it'll be getting you the same tree as likelihood. And we'll see later that there's some arguments in favor of likelihood. What I'm going to now shift a little bit to do in the last 10 minutes is to go back to talking about parsimony and start to think about characters where we do have some idea of probabilities of change. We have a model like the one I just showed you. And I'm going to argue that in certain cases that there will be that parsimony will be misleading. There are certain cases in which if we accumulate lots of data on particular kinds of trees, we will be systematically misled by parsimony. In statistical terms, that's a property called inconsistency. A consistent statistical estimate is a statistic, basically, I mean, there are formal definitions for it, but basically what it says is, if my estimation method, estimating something, here we're estimating the tree, will be consistent if, as you accumulate independent sources of data, independent characters, lots of them, if with enough characters, you have higher and higher probability of being led towards the true tree. There are lots of technicalities of exactly how you define that, but basically, if the piling up of more and more data ad nauseum leads you ultimately to the right answer. I mean, we all know, for example, if you're just drawing independent independently out of a normal distribution, if you can draw enough points, you will converge on estimating the mean of that normal distribution. If you're tossing coins and you want to estimate the probability of heads, if you toss it enough times, you'll get closer and closer to the true answer. There are discussions to be had about, well, exactly what do you mean by closer and closer. Okay, so what I'm going to do is imagine four tips, three possible unrooted trees. We're just doing parsimony. Forget about all the probabilities for the moment. And 0-1 characters. Okay. Now, the possible data that we might have includes all four both possibilities at each of the four tips. So there are 16 different patterns of data that we could see. Of the columns that we look at in the data matrix, there are really 16 different kinds of columns. And here they are. Okay, they're just the binary numbers from 0 up to 15. Now, if you take those and put them at the tips of the tree, here are the three possible unrooted tree topologies. If we put these data on, you can see instantly no changes are needed, so we write a 0 here. So what this column is going to be is how many changes are needed in those characters. If you put 0001, you'll need one change. In fact, you'll need one change on each of the three topologies. So this will be 000, that'll be 111, and you keep going. And what you'll find is a great many of these patterns only require one change. And when they do, it's the same. It's just a last minute change going to one tip. And it doesn't matter what topology you're on, you can always do that. So there's a lot of these rows where there's no difference between the three tree topologies in the score of the tree. But in slightly larger type are the ones where the topology does make a difference. When there are two zeros and two ones, this tree, the two zeros, if they're both at the same left-hand end and the ones are at the right-hand end, you require only a single change. Other way around, if there's two ones at the left and two zeros on the right, that's down here. Also takes only one change. For the other topologies, with this pattern, it takes two changes because the ones are on, one is on the left and one is on the right. So these are the patterns of data that differentiate between the topologies that give you different counts for the different topologies. And all the other ones, the ones that aren't purple here, don't actually affect your choice of tree. Okay, so there is a table of that. Let me see, I can't remember what order. Oh yeah, you could do the same with DNA. It's just that the table gets much longer. Here are the trees, here are the possible patterns. If they're all A's, 000. If there's three A's and a C, 111. These are in lexicographic order. They're in the dictionary order, with A, C, G, T changing, and then put a C here, and A, C, T, G, and then put a G here, and A, C, T, G here. And we fill in the table. And basically, the problem with that is we haven't even got out of the A's and we're already running off the screen. They're going to be 256 lines, 4 times 4 times 4 times 4, in the table, and I don't have the energy to do them all, so we put dot, 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 and here's T, 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 T down here with 0, 0, 0. Okay. Now you may say, okay, so you told us about this, so some sites are not. This is sometimes called informative, but statistically, all sites are informative, but for parsimony methods, this site is not parsimony informative in the sense that it doesn't give you a different number of counts on different trees. Okay. So we'll be interested in these informative sites, and where we're headed is to ask about their probabilities. So let me see how far we get with that. Okay. So the thing to notice is this informative site has two different, has one state, the same state, a different state, a different state. So what we're going to do is call that, say that that pattern is of the type XXYY. Okay, it's, where X and Y are just symbols for things that are the same and things that are different. So we can go through the table and we can assign such a type. Here is XXYX. Here it's XXYZ. Okay. It'll turn out that the ones that are parsimony informative are of the form X, X, Y, Y, or X, Y, Y, X, or X, Y, X, Y, where X is one of the four bases and Y is one of the other four bases. Or if we're in the state, if we're doing zeros and ones, where X is either zero or one and Y is the other one. So X could be one and Y could be zero, or X could be zero and Y could be one. So the only patterns that count are that matter to deciding which is the most parsimonious tree are these patterns that fall in, that have these pattern types. And when we count up characters, we will want to count, as we go through a big data set, say a long set of four aligned DNA sequences, if we can count up the number of sites, I'll call it N sub XXYY, that have this first pattern, the number of sites that have the second, and the number of sites that have the third, those three numbers will tell us what we need to know about which tree is preferred. Because the number of times you see all the other sites just doesn't matter. They're adding zero or one to all of these numbers. But in terms of picking the smallest parsimony score, the only one that will matter are those. And let me show you that. This gets us to just the right place. For the three trees that I showed you in the three columns, the first one will give you a parsimony score at those sites, which is 1 if it's XXYY, and for the other two types gives you a score of 2. So if you've got those counts, you say there's 17 of these characters, there's 19 of those, and there's 6 of those. The parsimony score at those sites that are parsimony informative will be, what did I say, 19? 17. 17 plus 2 times 19 plus 2 times 6. So if you just go through the data set and you count how many columns are in each of those, are each of these three informative types, you can figure it out. And if similarly for the other two trees, you get a similar count, only now the score is 1 if you have X, Y, X, Y. The score is 1 if you have X, Y, Y, X. And if you look back at those trees, you'll see that that's true. The nice thing, it's a trivial bit of mathematics, is just to say, well, what is this quantity? Well, it's just as if you scored 2 for each of those and then subtracted off 1 for the first one. So 1 times nxyy is equal to 2 times nxxyy minus 1 times xxyy. So this quantity here is equal to twice the sum of all three minus the number of the first one. This is twice the sum of all three minus the number of the second one. This is twice the number of all three minus the third one. So that gives you a simple lesson, and we'll end with that, that if I have the numbers and I want to know which tree is preferred, if I have 17 of these, 19 of those, and 6 of those, I simply look at the smallest of those numbers, the largest of those numbers. Because if 19 are in this pattern, then this number here, because that subtracted off here, this number here will be the biggest. Oh, sorry, will be the smallest. It'll have more subtracted off. I keep saying bigger instead of smaller and getting things reversed. But so this is by way of justifying that in a parsimony method, there are certain kinds of patterns of distribution of states that matter to the choices of best tree. And the thing you want to know is how many times each of those patterns occurs, and the one that occurs the most corresponds to the tree, in this four-tip case, corresponds to the tree that you're going to choose, the tree that parsimony will choose. So I hope I've at least convinced you that that's plausible. Where we pick up next time is to show you that in certain cases, the wrong tree gives you a higher expected number of occurrences of the pattern favoring it. And in those cases, parsimony will go down the drain. It will converge on the wrong answer. But those are somewhat extreme trees, and we'll get into that next time. So, thank you.